Heidi Holton, thanks for choosing this KAXE-KBXE conversation. We are member-supported radio, a National Public Radio affiliate in northern Minnesota. We need your support for our radio broadcasts, our online content, and our podcast. Go to KAXE.org, and thanks for listening. You're listening to KAXE KBXE. It's time for Dig Deep, our conversation where we get a chance to talk to liberal commentator Aaron Brown, our conservative commentator Chuck Marone. Today we're going to talk about elections, about election 2020, but not who's going to win, not the horse race, but kind of a deep dive into the hows and whys of politicians right now. But first, you guys need to write your essays, what I did on my summer vacation. Wow. I haven't been on in a while.
I didn't realize there's an election coming up. I had no inkling of that.
Yeah. So, Chuck, what'd you do on your summer vacation?
I coached girls softball, which is like the best thing I do in the course of a year. It's probably the thing that brings me the most joy, actually. I love these girls. And I got kind of, by the way they do drafting, which is really crazy when you're talking about 10, 11, 12-year-olds, like the combine kind of thing. I got stuck with the Bad News Bears team. So I literally got like the last 8 players nobody else wanted. They wound up to be not only the most beautiful girls and just like wonderful, great attitude, but they were pretty darn good. They were really fun. Like everybody else overlooked some pretty spectacular players. My family also were fortunate. I travel a lot, so I get a lot of frequent flyer miles. So we were able to take our first family European vacation. So we did London and Paris. And just to see my girls walk around a country where no one is speaking their language, I was really like the thrill of decades of waiting for this.
Yeah. So, what was the first time? How old were you the first time you went to Europe?
Oh, 25. Okay. So yeah, I was, we traveled a lot in the US because my parents were teachers when I got in like 11, 12 years old, they became teachers. And we had a farm otherwise, and we'd always take a big, long US vacation, but never overseas. Mm-hmm. So it's just fun to be able to do that and be able to have them. You know, we go to St. Francis Church in Brainerd, which is this beautiful cathedral. It's a really nice church. And I've told the girls, like, it's kind of a nice little church. And when you get over to St. Paul's, or, you know, we walked around Notre Dame, you couldn't go in, obviously, because of the fire problems. But for them to see these grand buildings, Versailles, mm-hmm. you just get a different sense of scale and history. And
it makes you realize how young our country is.
Oh, my gosh. And I think, you know, for kids, mine are 12 and 14, for them to be able to see that and experience that at that age, you're going through this period of time where, like, your world seems so small, and who's popular, and do I have the right clothes, and everyone's staring at me, and then to go and see this huge palace, and you're like, yeah, we're you know, it's a pretty big world, kid.
Well, Aaron, we'll get to you, but I also want to know, did you get asked at all about politics when you were in Europe?
The last time that we were in Paris was when Jesse Ventura was governor, and it's funny because people would talk to us as Americans, and then when they find out we're from Minnesota, they go, oh, Jesse, and they knew that. This time, no, not really. It was a little bit different vibe, and no.
Aaron Brown, it's time for your essay, what you did on your summer vacation.
Well, mine is similar in one key way. and that is that I was the assistant coach of my son's baseball team. And that was not something planned. There was a really go-get-em assistant coach cut, you know, super muscular. His kid ended up playing lacrosse, and they left. I was sitting there, and they needed a first base coach, and there began my summer romance with coaching.
They wow. hooked you in.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you like it?
I did like it. We also had the Bad News Bears, only instead of turning out to be pretty good, we kept losing. that's just a joke, I guess. But my son is on the team, of course, and he had a great season. He really came along, and I had the experience of seeing my son, and this is, I'm much more selfish. I'm not looking at the team. I'm looking at my kid. watching my son hit not one but several home runs, over the fence home runs, and this is something I never did as a kid. I was actually in the outfield watching one of these go over the fence on the other side of the outfield. I was in right and it went over the left field fence, and I swear I was ready to renounce all of my academic professional pursuits to say, yeah, my kid hit a homer. Yeah, because I was willing to give it all up.
Just you're going to become one of those dads.
The glory of it. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. I couldn't believe that feeling that it came over me watching that. And it's Little League, you know, so let's get real. It's Little League. Let's not get over.
But it's your kid.
But it's my kid. Yeah. And So that was fun. Did not go to Europe. Did go to the woods of Balsam Township a lot. And I've been writing. You know, Chuck's got his book coming out, and I'm a few steps behind him working on a book. And I got a little research in, a lot of microfilm over the summer.
Oh, I love microfilm.
You know, microfilm.
I used to make those microfilm when I worked in the library.
Yes,
the legislature.
And they're very much as you would remember
film,
them.
Not fiche.
Oh my goodness, what's the difference?
Well, that's all right. We don't need to get into that.
I think it's film, but I'm
okay.
That's what I would call it.
Yeah, we'll talk later.
Okay,
very in depth.
I think it's interesting because I have followed a little bit through Facebook vicariously the baseball exploits of Aaron's kids. And I will say, when I became a girls softball coach, and this was, I think, my fifth summer doing it, I quickly learned that coaching girls softball is not about teaching fundamentals. There's a little bit of that, but it's a lot about hugs and encouragement and like, hey, you're doing great.
Yeah.
Like, stick with it. Like, oh, I'm really proud of you. And the amazing thing is that the kids like really respond to that. They're like, oh, you think I'm good? Like, I guess I'll play well.
There's something I really noticed on our team, mostly 10, 11 year olds. When they all were focused on actually trying, you know,
right.
The team would be fun to watch. You know, that's when we would win our games. But there were a lot of times where they just simply, and boys, maybe it's different than girls. I don't know how emotional it was. They just weren't like, they were just like, their brain was somewhere else. They just weren't thinking about it anymore. And they just, you know, are screwing around. And is it that on and off button was something else.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Anybody listening out there, if you get the opportunity to participate as a coach, go do it and do it with love, not with the like competitive rip their throat out kind of mentality. And I've found it to be one of the most rewarding things I've done in my whole life.
You realize the role of providing the experience to all those kids. And a lot of them, you know, their parents couldn't be involved because of work and everything else. And so for them, it was having coaches there to just make sure the thing could happen. That's why our coach of our team, he was called in at the last minute too, because we didn't even have a coach for our team. And so, you know, but this is what it was all about, though, providing the experience to the kids.
Well, it's funny because kids have parents and they have teachers and they have these organized things. I distinctly remember my like fifth grade softball coach and my, you know, fourth grade basketball coach. And I'm sure for them, and I don't want to impose too much, but I'm sure for them it was like, oh, I got to go coach this. You know, like they were asked at the last minute and they didn't put their heart into it. But I, as an adult now, 46 years old, looking back, they were such influential people to me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you just realize when you're in this spot and can look at these, you know, these young, for our case, these young girls who, you know, get a lot of joy and pride out of doing this. It's such a fun thing to realize that you're impacting their lives in such positive ways.
Well, I don't have kids, but the best part of my summer was being a clerk at the chicken judging for 4-H at the Itasca County Fair.
I saw you doing that. That was cool.
At Itasca County Fair.
Yes.
Okay.
That's my favorite thing. And I grew up with the Crow Wing County Fair.
Yeah.
Went often. We lived real near there.
Actually judging the chickens, though.
No, that's an FDA job. I mean, that's like official USDA, something like that. It's a guy named Zeb Scow in an official, a lot of patches, kind of like a doctor's coat.
Yeah.
Yeah. So no, I was just checking him in, and then my husband was the announcer. But every year we end up on Thursday nights at the fair to watch the chicken judging because it is like going back in time. It's the kids in their white shirts. They have to wear black pants. They're holding their chickens.
Wow.
They've got to follow these rules as Zeb walks. They have to pivot. They have to always keep their eyes on him. And it's
the birds or the kids?
The kids, not the birds. Yeah. And then there's a showmanship round where the kids have to answer questions about poultry. Because it's,
serious?
I shouldn't say chicken. There were also turkeys and pigeons, but mostly chickens. And so, yeah, they were asked lots of questions and needed to bone up before their possibility to go to the state fair. So, yeah, it was very fun. We do that occasionally. We volunteer throughout the year for different 4-H things. And it's kind of fun to see all the things in 4-H that are not, I always thought of it as more of an ag sort of a thing. And we've done things like speech, mm-hmm. you know, speech things. We've done like a fashion show. We've judged. I mean, it's a lot of fun. What we did on our summer vacation was kind of a fun. And I think this might be indicative of no one wants to talk about politics.
Yeah, no, we're going into this gingerly, and it kind of feels like a parallel to the real world.
So we're going to start this conversation. We'll continue it through this Dig Deep series on election of 2020. And it's already begun, which is hard to believe. Where do we start with this? Some of the messaging we're hearing already, the debates, there's just a lot of things going on and you don't know what to pay attention to. It's easy to just shut down from everything when you start mm-hmm. seeing polls and you wonder who'd they poll and how do they know all this stuff? And
the classic thing to say is, oh boy, it's early. It's not even 2020 yet and we're talking about the presidential election. And that's true. And if you compare, and I've actually done research and written about how in other countries that have elections, the campaign period is by law defined as a shorter period. Ours doesn't have any restriction and therefore begins when the market dictates it should begin. This is not unusual for recent modern political campaigns. If you go back to 2016, 2012, 2008,
Has there ever been a push to have the restriction on?
Maybe there's been banter about it, but it's never gotten anywhere close to reality.
Okay.
No, yeah. and our campaign structure is just different. I mean, we have election every 4 years. I was just in London, as I said, and there's people, they're protesting Brexit. And if they talked politics, that's what they want to talk about, is Brexit. And just yesterday, they're trying to call snap elections, which would happen literally in 6 weeks from the day they decided they're going to have an election.
Normal scheduled elections, it's like a 10-week period. I take that back. It might even be 6 weeks. In Canada, there was a big controversy over the last election. The feeling was it was going to take way too long. It was starting way too early, and I think it was something like 12 weeks. Which was atypically long for a campaign season in Canada. And there's some reasons for that. You know, our party structure is different. In a lot of European countries, Canada, and a lot of countries all over the world, there's multiple parties. And the way governments are formed, whether you call it Congress or whatever you want to call it, is after the election, if one party doesn't have a majority, the parties will work on a coalition to create a government, and they'll work out a deal among the parties for policy, for who gets to be the prime minister, for who gets to be the committee chairpersons or whoever. Our country does that differently. We've kind of boiled down to two parties, and the coalitions of our world all exist within those parties. The idea is that, there's a winner in an election. They will enact the agenda of that one party because that party won the election. And we can get into why that's complicated. But for presidential politics, that's what this is. Parties are not really just negotiating who will be at the head of their ticket next year. They're negotiating which policy or style or rhetoric they want elevated. And that takes time. And there's a lot of interested parties, not just political parties, but interested interests, people, industries, trade groups, organizations that have opinions about all this. Plus, you have the media structure of competition. And the only real competition are those primaries where there's people voting and there's a winner. Well, we're months from that. So how do they compete now? Well, money, debates, and the subjective opinions of people who watch those debates will determine who's ahead.
I feel like there's a military metaphor here that for me is comforting, or at least it's a way to think about this, mm-hmm. is that what we have set up, instead of an ongoing regular set of skirmishes, what we have set up is like one big battle royale every 4 years at the federal level. Every 2 years, here offsetting that at the state level. So every other year we have the big battle. And if you think about like a military, if we know we're having a battle on like X date, you can just back up from that and say, okay, in order to have our troops in like the maximum position to score the greatest victory against this huge rival at this time, we have to do these things to get stuff in place. And I mean, we're at the point now where we're actually, 2 years into the process. The process up to this point has been, how do we get people registered to vote? How do we get our troops kind of lined up? How do we start vetting our candidates early? what you're really doing is you're building to this culmination point that will take place in November, a year from this November. And that creates this, in one way, a focal point we can all focus on, but it also creates this kind of low leverage, continual building process. It's like being on the edge of a battle looming. There's a line in the last Lord of the Rings movie where it's like, you know, being on the edge of the battle is worse than being in it. And in some ways, we live in the United States on the edge of this battle. Mm-hmm. We can see it coming. We can see it over the ridge. The troops are starting to gather. The forces are starting to weigh in. And we know that this is going to get bad at some point. We know, like, things are going to happen. We have to sit here and watch it. And there's nothing we can really...
Yeah, and you can't turn back.
No, you can't deflect it.
One of the things you hear a lot going into this particular cycle is how bad it's going to be.
Right.
Because the last one was pretty bad. The rhetoric, the words said in public by public officials has been bad. And the only thing you can imagine is, well, with the increased drama of President Trump's re-election campaign, with the increased drama of control of Senate and Congress and the direction of the country on a bunch of critical issues.
Potential Supreme Court nomination.
Right, the Supreme Court's already changed, and it really could change, I won't say permanently because nothing is permanent, but generational change is certainly on the cusp of that. And so knowing all that, knowing it's just going to be terrible, speaking for myself, you know, and I think all of us could share some of this, like personal social media, watching people I know and their reactions to the things going on in this country and the amount of stress that people are under in their personal lives just over the observance of a national campaign that is not yet begun, but is begun. Where the previous election, the 2018 election, was really just reconnaissance for using your military example for this election. And that, you know, the hope that this election might settle things, but of course it won't. And so, that part is what's driving people. That's why people say, oh, it's too early. We can't talk about this. I don't want to think about this. And then the result is, I think what we're seeing is a smaller group of people within the country who are paying nonstop attention to this, to these machinations of the candidates, the million Democrats and the one Republican, or I guess two or three Republicans technically. But and then a whole sea of people who are like, wake me up next year when we have two candidates. And I'm guilty of that just as much as anybody. People have asked, you know, I'm the liberal guy, so who am I with in the Democratic primary? Well, my answer's been, well, I'll make that decision when they all fit on one screen, is what I've been saying. Because there were 20 candidates participating in the debates at one point. And I said, well, when you get down to 10 and you can fit them all on one stage in one debate, maybe then I'll make a decision. Well, that's what a lot of people are doing, you know, and maybe not 10, maybe they want to wait till 2. You know, you have to realize a lot of people don't follow politics that closely. The only problem in the American system is that by the time you get down to 2,
the decision's pretty much made.
The decision is made and you have a binary choice, and this is where you hear people say, "Well, how did this end up being our two choices?" You know. But that's the system. So really, the system actually could work better if we had near total engagement during the candidate selection process, but we've typically not had that. And and nor is it probably reasonable to expect that of our society, though it'd be lovely. You know, a lot of things would be lovely if we all got along better and, you know, used our words more carefully and thought about the 50-year implications of our policies, et cetera. That'd be lovely, but that's not typically what people have been doing. So.
You're listening to Dig Deep. We'll continue in our next segment talking politics, Election 2020. We're with Chuck Marone, our conservative commentator, and Aaron Brown, our liberal.